You're listening to The Point. At the age of 14, Adrienne Brojeur was awakened in the middle of the night. Her mother, Malabar, giddy with excitement, shared she'd been kissed by her husband's best friend. She swore Adrienne to secrecy. At that moment, Adrienne not only became her mother's confidant, she became an accomplice to an affair that went on for years. Adrienne Brojeur's new memoir, Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me, explores the complexity of her relationship with her mother and how corrosive a secret can be. She joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you, Mindy. I'm happy to be here.
Now, your mother, Malabar, was a force. Beautiful, intelligent, a skilled writer, a gourmet cook. She exuded confidence in just about everything she did. So before that moment, she bursts into your bedroom to share that secret. How would you describe your relationship with her?
You know, I would say it was a pretty typical parent-child relationship. I was always, like most children, in my mother's thrall, eager to, you know, have her love, all those kind of things. But we had a lot of fun, and it seemed relatively normal.
So how did your relationship with your mother change after that moment?
I mean, it was one of those absolutely pivotal moments in my life where I think before that moment, I was firmly in the camp of childhood. I was my mother's daughter. And after this moment, and of course, at the time, I didn't realize it would go on to begin this epically long and romantic love affair. But after that moment, right away in real time, I had become her confidant and best friend and really entered this very provocative adult world.
Your mother was married to a man she professed to love even while she was having an affair with his best friend. How did she justify the affair to herself and to you?
I believe she did love her second husband very much. He had had 4 strokes in 5 days right when they got married and became a very, very different person. But how she justified it to me, which at the time I bought hook, line, and sinker, and I also think she justified it to herself by saying, "None of us meant to fall in love. This is just something that happened. But above all, we don't want to hurt our spouses." And by that, she was including her husband and her lover's wife. These were couple friends. And both of the other parts of the couple were not in good health. And they decided that rather than leave them brokenhearted, I mean, obviously now this all sounds like a great rationale, but rather than do that, they were going to do the right thing, which was to, you know, stick with their spouses and just keep the affair going.
Now, you believe your stepfather likely knew about the relationship between his wife and his best friend. Why do you think he didn't confront either of them?
I don't know that he knew. On some level, the relationship that my mother had with Ben was just so electric. You couldn't be in a room with them without just sort of feeling the sparks of attraction. And they had this, I don't know, this chemical reaction to each other. So it seemed very hard to imagine that anyone didn't know. And there was certainly a lot of talk. According to Ben, at one point in time, my stepfather did confront him. And then they sort of both chose denial as the easier path.
There's a point when a nurse caring for your ill stepfather finds out about the affair and blackmails your mother. Your mother is distraught, but you cleverly figure out a way to thwart the blackmailer. Did you ever find yourself wishing the affair would be exposed so you could be freed from that secret?
Well, in the end, the affair was exposed, and I was freed from the secret. But I think the problem with, you know, the corruption and the corrosive quality of secret keeping, especially at such a young age, and it was really a formative part of my youth, is that it has a very long arm. I mean, it is the lens through which I grew up, and there's this legacy of secret keeping and deception in my family that I was determined to put an end to.
Now, you don't share the complicity in your mother's affair with many people, but after college, you do tell a boyfriend. He's appalled that your mother would burden you with her infidelity. And in that moment, you defend your mother, but his reaction stays with you. Looking back, do you think that was a turning point in how you started to see your mother and her actions?
Well, there were so many turning points. I mean, one of the interesting things, of course, is we all only have one childhood. And in that way, our childhoods are normalized to ourselves. And I really, you know, it's taken me years to understand how unusual mine was. So, yes, there were many markers along the way. And it just it took time and space to internalize all of it. Also, there was a great deal of shame for my role at different points in my life. So it's just, it's been a lifetime process of kind of untangling myself from the web of it.
Now, Ben is a pseudonym you use for the man with whom your mother has the affair. And I don't want to reveal how, when and how the affair becomes known to Ben's wife, Lily, but it does happen. And at this point, your stepfather has been dead for several years. When the affair becomes public, the pain of the deceit is compounded because it happens just as you're about to marry Ben and Lily's son, Jack. So describe how your world felt during those weeks and months after the affair is revealed.
Well, you know, it's a bit what you said before. There was one part relief and two parts panic. Of course, a huge part of me thought, now I will finally be able to get on with my life and to be known and seen by Jack, who was Ben and Lily's son. Because I think the hardest part of holding a secret is that you actually are prevented from becoming known and having really intimate relationships because, of course, you're keeping something from the world. I think Carl Jung described it as psychic poison, I think was his word. But that's very much how it was. So I had this notion that all would be, you know, we would have this new opportunity. But the fact is, I think too much had already happened and the secret had done too much damage, although we still got married. I think between Jack's reluctance to want to dig a whole lot further and my reluctance to do that myself at that particular point in time, we just weren't quite ready to dig into what it actually meant for us as a couple.
So what happened to your relationship with your mother once the affair is public?
You know, my relationship with my mother has gone through so many ups and downs over the years. Clearly, we have an intense bond. She and I have gone through great periods of estrangement in our lives. One of the things that this book did, and in a very surprising way, exploring this painful part, is I developed a huge compassion for every character, my mother included. You know, you can't really dive deeply into someone's life and research it and explore it without developing a compassion for who they are. And my mother went through, I mean, some unimaginable tragedies in her life. Her parents were twice divorced from each other. She discovered that her father had a secret family. She lost her first child. I mean, I could go on and on, but it enabled me to not say everything she did was okay by any means, but it gave me an ability to understand her more. And I think once we know anyone's story fully, it's much easier to forgive people.
Yeah. Now, your mother and Ben eventually marry after both of their spouses die. When that happens, your relationship with your mother changes significantly. It's maybe the part of the book where you feel the most sense of loss. Would you say that was the lowest point in your relationship with your mother?
Probably, yes. I think that was. There was a point during when she and Ben got together, when Jack and I were splitting up, and I was kind of messing up this version of events that she had worked so hard to achieve. And she kind of cast me out of the fold, and it was incredibly painful for me at the time.
You go through a period of severe depression. You work with a therapist, take medication, but nothing helps for long. Your father's second wife sees you struggling and gives you books. You hadn't been a big reader before that time, but the books become a life raft of sorts. What were some of the books she gave you, and can you explain why they resonated with you?
Absolutely. So I remember literally the first package of books she gave me on the night that I first met her, which included Jim Harrison's Dalva, Barbara Kingsolver's, oh, now I can't remember whether it was Animal Dreams or The Bean Trees, and Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. And all three of these books featured young female protagonists who were really struggling with some issue in their lives. And I think it cracked me open to this world of literature where you basically get to escape the bubble of your own experience and enter another world, because every book is a world, of course, and you get to see how someone different from yourself deals with their problems. And it just, it ignited something in me. And I became the most voracious reader and have been ever since then. And I think, you know, therapy, friendship, and books, they all had equal parts in really helping me dig my way out of a very desperate time.
As an adolescent, you spent summers in Nauset, where your mother has a home. It's also where you were witness and conspirator in her affair. Was there a time it was difficult for you to come to the Cape because of that association?
Well, there was a time that I didn't have a place to stay because I'd always stayed in my mother's home. So when she and I had, you know, probably a period of estrangement for some long, about a decade, I literally didn't get to Orleans or Nauset very often. But for a variety of reasons, I have always felt Cape Cod is just the most special place in my life. I get that sense of coming home as I go over the bridge and smell that brackish air. And for me, I think, you know, my parents were divorced when I was young. There was New York, there was Connecticut, there were different apartments and our new home in Massachusetts. But the Cape has been constant for all my 50-some years. Mm-hmm. My father has a house in North Truro. He was kind enough to give it to me for a couple weeks each summer when my mother and I didn't have a relationship. And I just, it has been my touchstone. It's just the place I feel at home.
The early chapters of the book describe your maternal grandparents' mercurial relationship and their physical abuse of your mother. You also write about the death of your parents' first child, your brother, when he was just two. How do you think these experiences shaped Malabar as a woman and as a mother?
You know, I think my mother was a very lonely person, which I didn't realize for a long time. I mean, I think it's hard for a child to realize that. She was an only child. Her father lived in India for much of her childhood. Her mother was, it sounds very, quite alcoholic. And, you know, it sounds like she was terribly lonely. Mm. I think she didn't have a successful first marriage with my father. And then with the loss of her first child, I mean, you know, it's unimaginable, the profound loss that must have been. But I think, you know, I think it depends a lot on your view. I mean, some people read this book and they think Malabar is, you know, all one thing or all the other. I mean, we're all some point, no one's black and white. We're all some point of gray. And what I will say is my mother was a survivor. And, you know, I have to admit that although I don't think much of what she did was right, some part of me admires that she went for love.
Mm. Now, you mentioned how doing the book helped you understand her more. But did you find yourself becoming more sympathetic toward her once you had children of your own?
You know, I think we all become more sympathetic to our parents when we have children, simply because whatever we imagined having children was going to be like, it is so much harder. I mean, no one doesn't say that or feel that. It just, you know, someone was there wiping our runny noses and, you know, all the things that we do for our children, the sleepless nights. So, of course, you understand your parents in a different way when you have children.
How did you begin to rebuild your relationship with your mother?
You know, I mean, over time and slowly, I think it's a long and involved process. And I'm sure, you know, in that way, if this doesn't sound too strange, it will go on years after her death as well. You know, we have conversations with the people we love in our minds, on the page, in person, and we try to sort through what's happened to ourselves.
I read that your mother suffers from dementia and that you have a good relationship with her now. Did you ever talk with her about how your role in her affair impacted you?
Of course, you know, many times and in different ways, and probably about 4 or 5 years ago, I feel very grateful that when I told her that I needed to write this book, you know, she gave me her blessing. She was a great chronicler of her own life, and she had all sorts of scrapbooks and food journals and obviously these recipes and articles that she wrote that were, you know, of great assistance to writing the book.
How much of the story have you shared with your children?
You know, my son's only 11 and has
still kind of young, yep.
very little interest. You know, football and other things are more important. I have told my daughter, who happens to be precisely the age I was when all this was happening in my life, I've told her the nuts and bolts of it. She has a lovely relationship with her grandmother, and I in no way want to interfere with that. But what's interesting to me is that although she's had access to the book, I love the fact that she's a 14-year-old with this huge and passionate life, you know, of school and games and sports, and her reading preference is Rick Riordan and world-building fiction. And I actually take it as such a great thing as someone who was so obsessed at that age with my mother's interior life that she's like, yeah, I'll get to it. I'll read it.
What were some of the reasons you decided to not just write about this part of your life, but make it public?
You know, I don't know many writers. I mean, unless you're keeping a journal and that's all you plan to do. I mean, we write these things to figure something out, to sort through bits of our life, and I think to show it to a public. I just think that is what writers do. So I don't know that I have much more to say about that than that.
Did your brother or ex-husband have any reservations about you sharing this story?
You know, it's funny. When I sold the book, my editor asked, you know, does Jack know? And I thought, of course he does. And then I thought, does he? And then I looked back onto my emails and I found an email to Jack, who remains a good friend, in which the subject line was 3 to 5 year warning. And I said, look, I really have to face this and I have to write this book. And please let me know if there's anything off, you know, just that's off limits, that you feel protective of your father or your mother. You know, my goal above all was not to hurt anyone, not to settle any scores. It was really to focus so keenly on my mother and me. And I took to heart, there's this beautiful line in Vivian Gornick's book, The Situation and the Story, which says, in order for the drama to deepen, we must see the loneliness of the monster and the cunning of the victim. And I had that line taped to my computer screen, and I just believe fully that to write a good and beautiful memoir, you have to be as hard on yourself and let go of the tight grip you might have had on your version of the narrative and try to see as much as possible.
You've had a long and successful career in publishing and editing numerous memoirs. How did editing other people's stories help you shape your own?
You know, I think every writer owes a huge debt of gratitude to all the books and works and authors that have come before them, even the ones that they didn't read, because they've all influenced each other. And it's as if we're having this one long conversation. I think editing was so helpful to me in probably very subconscious ways of just seeing so many stories and seeing how they built differently and how they were structured differently. And I certainly wasn't taking notes as in, you know, oh, this is a good thing for when I write my own book. But I think I internalized a lot, and it was really a privilege to work on so many books.
Family dynamics can be challenging, and there's often guilt and blame from things that happened decades ago, living just below the surface of these relationships. So what do you hope people in these situations will take away from your book?
Well, you know, I hope that anyone who has asked themselves, sort of, am I destined to become my parent, and feels helpless in that scenario, knows that despite the fact that the past doesn't go anywhere, I mean, the past is prologue, it stays with us, you can move beyond it. And you can, if you're willing, rather than to just keep tamping down these hard moments and secrets in our lives, if you just sit with them and shine a spotlight on them and allow them not to define you, but look at them closely, I do think you can move beyond them.
Adrian Bojor's new memoir is titled Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. She'll be speaking at the Sandwich Public Library Tuesday, November 12th, and the Falmouth Public Library Wednesday, November 13th. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Gary Mott and Dave Goodman for production assistance in Boston.